Well, I will have to be honest with you. The further we get into this series, the more I do it with fear and trepidation. We're dealing with a lot of sensitive issues in terms of our culture, and yet we want to continue to come back to the scriptures and look at the example of Christ in terms of how do we continue to press into these issues and represent Christ well in not only in our own context, but in the world that we live with. This morning, I want to begin by quoting some verses out of Erwin Lutzer's new book, We Will Not Be Silenced. It's a really interesting book. I think he does a really good job of addressing a lot of different issues. Obviously, it's one voice, only one voice in the larger context of voices that we absolutely need to be listening to. But because of one aspect of what we're dealing with in terms of the text, I want to take a smaller and yet a smaller issue, sort of a sub-issue that sort of contributes to our concern and issues, not only in our culture, in other cultures, different ethnic groups, and yet at the same time try to also challenge ourselves to the call that God has upon ourselves. One of the things he talks about is this whole issue of our diversity and how it can make us stronger, and yet at the same time people can use diversity to drive us apart. In one section of this, he talks about how critical the role of families are in our national struggle. We all know, and I don't know if this would be an assumption of yours, but I would work from the premise that because we live in a fallen world and every human being is affected by sin and brokenness, that there is discrimination in every aspect of all of different life. That you can't go anywhere in the world and not see a context or a group or an ethnic group where some kind of prejudice, exploitation, and discrimination takes place. We often ignore it in our own because if we can insulate ourselves from that and do our own thing, we tend to not be concerned about it. He does make a statement in here that he's quoting an individual by a psychiatrist, Theodore Dalrymple, I guess is his name. Says, life at the bottom, the worldview that makes the underclass. And he makes a statement that, again, you'll have to remember, you think about this in terms of one small issue within the bigger issue, and yet this is a significant contribution. And that he says this, and if you stay with me through the whole message, I think you'll get sort of the drift of where it's going. He says, one of the issues that most powerfully influences and holds people down as underclass or as a oppressed minority is not race, but moral relativism. Obviously, that's not the whole picture, but that's one of the things he talks about. As he goes on in the book, he quotes him and says this, according to him and his research, the foremost perpetrator of the underclass is uncommitted sexual relations. He goes on in this discussion to talk about how the family and how it's deteriorated has contributed to the oppression of certain groups of people and the struggle that we have in terms of understanding our relationships with one another. In this context, he quotes Barack Obama. Back in 2008, he was speaking at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago on June the 15th, 2008, and he was speaking to mostly black and brown America in this speech. So these are his words. And then we'll show how it's relevant to what we're talking about this morning. In there, he has a couple of paragraphs that he quotes. He says, and this is what Barack Obama said, if we are honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers also are missing from too many lives and too many homes. They have abandoned their responsibility, acting like boys instead of men, and the foundation of our families are weaker because of it. You and I know that how true this is in the African-American community. We know that more than half of all African-American children live in a single-parent household, a number that has doubled since we were children. We know the statistics that children who grow up without a father are 5 times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime, 9 times more likely to drop out of schools, and 20 times more likely to end up in prison. They are most likely to have behavioral problems or run away from home or become teenage parents themselves, and the foundations of our community are weaker because of it. But we also need families to raise our children. We need fathers to realize that responsibility does not end at conception. We need them to realize that what makes you a man is not the ability to have a child, it's the courage to raise one. One of the reasons why I even introduced this thought is because of the text that we're dealing with this morning. Jesus has gone into Samaria, which we all know has huge ethnic animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans. If you had not joined us last week, the Samaritans were kind of a mixed race of Gentiles and Jews that were sort of imported and colonized there by conquering nations, mainly Assyria. And the way that they kept from groups of people from revolting and rising up is they would mix them up, and so they'd have language constraints, and yet they had to figure out how to live, and so there ended up being this sort of mixed marriages and interbreeding and figuring out a way to make life work because of the oppression of being conquered and then colonized in areas that were not of their choice. And as Jesus walks into Samaria, he sits down at the Jacob's well and meets the Samaritan woman and begins a conversation with her, which by the text is extraordinarily rare because the Jews had no dealings with Samaritans. When the disciples go into town to get food, it wasn't that the animosity was so deep that they couldn't find groceries, so to speak. But when they come back, they are astonished that Jesus is talking to this woman. Not only in terms of being a woman, but being a Samaritan woman. And so their instinct, their instant reaction would seem to indicate that they clearly are dealing with prejudicial perspective and a worldview that just, that's inbred in them. And so as Jesus has this conversation, as we walk through John 4, we're going to discover that Jesus is going to try to crash the grates of this prejudice and this ethnic discrimination and help his disciples see a new trajectory in life in terms of caring for people. As we move through there, let me begin by simply reading the text so that you know specifically what we're dealing with. As Jesus talks to her about giving her living water, and she seems quite confused by that, and that's understandable, Jesus finally says to her, before they move any further in the conversation, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "Well, you are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one that you have now is not your husband. What you said is true." Now, one of the problems with reading a text like this, in fact, the next verse, she responds by saying, "I perceive that you might be a prophet." The problem with a text like this is it's almost impossible to feel the emotional angst going on. And it's impossible for me to not read this without thinking that this Jewish man who's talking to this Samaritan woman, that at least on her side, is that there's anxiety all over the place. That she is surprised by Jesus initiating this conversation, and he's the one that initiates it. They talk about something that might satisfy a deep need in her life, and then Jesus swings this conversation before they move any further and says, "Go get your husband." Now, in our culture, there's a lot of people that would take that as an insult. What makes you think I need a husband or have one? I don't need a husband to do my thing. We have our own sense of prejudices about what gives us value and significance, and I know some people that would be profoundly upset if Jesus ever asked that question in our day and age. But in this particular context, we will discover that Jesus is not doing it as to dismiss her or say anything condescending, but what he is doing is actually recognizing the compromise she has to deal with. And in the public arena, I want to just remind you of a couple things that were certainly true of the Jewish culture and their particular group, as well as what probably took place in terms of Samaria. Since they had a mix of Gentiles and other people who believed other religions, there's probably some accommodation and other things that don't match in terms of what the Jews were to live by. But in any event, there are some things that she as a woman especially would have to deal with. And if we really got into here, we'd deal with certainly the profound systemic prejudice towards women that really was exuded in these particular cultures. Joachim Jeremiah says this: "It was disgraceful for a scholar to speak with a woman in the street. A woman who conversed with everyone in the street could, like the woman who worked at her spinning in the street," and that's not like quilting, that's something else, "be divorced without the payment prescribed in the marriage statement." There's other statements that come out of some of the documents of that century that says any woman who went out without this headdress, the coverings that they often wear in the Middle East, without her face being hidden, committed such an offense against good taste that her husband had the right, and indeed the duty, to put her away from him, and was under no obligation to pay the sum of money to which, on divorce, the wife had a right by virtue of the very marriage contract. There are other things. That's a little bit of a taste of the public element of it. I've read several documents and things that talk about how women in that particular culture had no public voice. They were basically constrained to the home. If they had daughters, they were basically invisible. They were not allowed to go out and do their own thing, at least in the terms of the strictest laws of the culture. And that even, for instance, when a husband thought he would marry off his daughter, and this was often to protect their legacy and their heritage, he could arrange for that up to the age of 12 and a half. So a lot of marriages were arranged before a girl reached 12 and a half years of age. So when they were 10, 11, 12, that's when fathers often arrange marriages with another family, often relatives, in order to protect family inheritance and property and so on and so forth. And but after 12 and a half, the dad could not arrange a marriage without her consent. So if he arranged with the ugly duckling down the road and she didn't like it, she actually had a right to say, I don't think I want to do that. I don't know how a 13-year-old debates that with a dad in a culture that has given him sort of unilateral authority, but that was part of the equation. There's other things that we could talk about in addition to the statements here, but a husband had all kinds of universal rights. He had the right to claim anything that a wife had found. If she found something, he could simply claim it. He had all rights to her manual work, so that if in the context of working, and wives were allowed to help their husbands in certain professions, so the rules weren't universally kept in some respects, then he had the right to simply claim all of her earnings in that particular sense. Wife was obligated to obey her husband as she would a master. In fact, some documents would describe the difference between a wife and, let's say, a slave as simply the marriage contract, that if things went bad and they divorced, she was entitled to resources to help sustain her outside of that marriage, where a slave would not have any of those rights. There's other statements. Husband could force a vow on his wife unless it discredited or disgraced her in the public eye. There's other statements. For instance, relationship between children and parents were also determined by the woman's duty of obedience to her husband. So I'm hoping you're catching a sense that there happened to be, within the context of both the Jewish culture and their ethnic group, as well as the Samaritans, that there was some inherent things, even some would claim things that they'd call from the Bible or from the scriptures, that actually ended up being extremely discriminatory and prejudicial towards women and children and individuals. The two most difficult ones that they had to, according to Jeremias, is that polygamy was permissible, that wives had to tolerate the idea that there were concubines, other women who were in the house that the husband had access to and could do as he wished, and she had no standing to protest against it. The other was the right to divorce, was almost exclusively the right of the husband, that the women had no claim except in a few exceptions where she could actually file for divorce and separate for him for his behavior, which again goes to sort of the systemic hypocrisy that men could do whatever they want and was right in their eyes, and they had all the control to keep their wives at bay or for protesting at all. I think we will discover, because of the brokenness of humanity, that you will look at any particular infrastructure, you will look at any particular culture, you'll look at any particular ethnic group, and you will always find certain systemic exploitation and elements that manipulate and exploit others. Now, that's not to diminish the things that are in front of us on the table, but as Jesus looks at this woman and finally changes the conversation as he starts talking about living water, and she doesn't know it yet, but she's talking with the Messiah and the one who can change everything, that he says, hang on, before we go any further on this, I want you to go get your husband, I believe, because he doesn't want to put her in a position, whether publicly or privately, that she gets hammered by the culture or decimated by her husband, because she's off talking and making deals, as it were, with someone that's not, without his permission. And so Jesus hits the brakes on the conversation, and he says, listen, I want you to go and get your husband. But he says, I want you to get him and invite him to come back here, and I want to talk to both of you. It's extraordinary that Jesus would do that. And yet, I believe Jesus is not only understanding the dilemma he can place her in the culture she's living, and he respects that to a point where he can continue the conversation, but he also knows that he's got a bigger picture in mind here. And one of the dangers that we run into, at least in our whole ethnic clash that we run into and these cultural clashes that we run into, is that we like to, you know, if that was us, we'd probably plow in and just keep pushing. We'd probably do all that we can, and we wouldn't pause to respect the cultural practices that are true in other cultures that may not be true in ours. And yet Jesus is sensitive to that, and he doesn't need to learn it. He has a sense of insight to it. But one of the postures we have to do is we have to learn to learn. We have to have a teachable heart, because we think we've got it all figured out at times, and there's no way that we can understand the cultural practices, the expectations of other cultures and ethnic groups just because they live down the street. And that's one of the things that's probably gotten us into some of the most extreme problems, is that we just think we ought to fix it based on what we want to do, rather than what we'll hear the cries and the pleas of people to listen to them, to help them deal with the things that they're going through. Now, the response of the woman is simple and interesting. She responds to Jesus by simply saying, I have no husband. Now, if we can pause and again try to get a feeling for the discussion, here's Jesus, he's at the well, the woman's there, there's nobody else around, and yet Jesus suddenly dives into personal matters that some of you would have no problem doing. This probably wouldn't be my first go-to part of the discussion. That's just me. I'm too chicken to do that kind of stuff. But in the process, he says, go get your husband, and she responds, well, I don't have a husband. Now, it's truthful, it's honest, but clearly it's incomplete. Do I blame her? Not at all. Here's a Samaritan woman interacting with a Jewish man, and she already will believe that according to the different cultural practices and stigmas and stereotypes, that she isn't worth anything more than a Gentile anyway, and so I would think she would expect to get hammered for disclosing everything. And so it's, I think the tension just kind of notched up a little bit, because Jesus is asking personal questions. Now, that may sound offensive to you, but one of the things Jesus is doing is that instead of just living with stereotypes and labels and profiling, he's starting to get to know the real person in real life and the story and the journey that she's on. Again, one of those things that we often don't do is that we don't treat people like they have a human life and they're broken like we are, and that they've been going through stuff in life. And this is what opens the door in terms of this discussion, which will certainly help the disciples later, is that instead of fighting the labeling and the stereotypes, Jesus goes to find out the reality of this woman and what her journey is. Now, Jesus is able to do something here that you and I would probably have a hard time doing, unless like she had five white circles around five fingers or something, I don't know. All I can assume at this point is the Spirit of God gives Jesus insight into this woman's situation that I don't know how else he would get it. I don't think Jesus tends to wildly guess. I think he does everything according to the leading of the Father. And so Jesus' response is this: you are right in saying, I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true. Now, if I was a woman, I don't know if I'd just go into flat-out panic at this point, or whether I'd just be stunned by the fact that he knows this. Now, when you jump to the next text where it says, oh, I discern that you're a prophet, doesn't really catch the mood of the moment, I don't think. Now, there's first of all, we make the assumptions that if she's had five husbands, she's been through five divorces. That's probably a pretty good inductive conclusion in terms, but it's not necessarily all true. For instance, she could have been a widow. She could have had some of these husbands that are died, but if you jump to the conclusion that, okay, well, you and your husband couldn't get along, you obviously did something wrong, you couldn't get along, you didn't work on it hard enough, you didn't go to enough counseling, and I've got a good therapist you ought to see, you may probably make a judgment about her character and her choices that may be a bit unfounded. Again, another one of those things that we tend to do is we assume we know people when we don't have a clue. We assume we know things about people and we don't have a clue. Jeremiah said, as a widow, a woman was still bound to her husband, that if he died without leaving a son, if you go back to Deuteronomy 25, some of this is explained there, but in this case, if she didn't have any sons, she had to wait, unable to make any move on her side until her husband's brother or brothers had decided whether they would contract with her in terms of what they call a Levirate wedding or marriage, where the brother would then marry his brother's wife in order to bring sons into the world to protect their legacy and their heritage and their property, so that wouldn't be lost. Now, they would have to all go through that process where they'd have to decide whether they were going to do that or not. And they could refuse and formally say, no, I don't want to do that. And we have stories in the Old Testament that where some of this takes place, because you deal with Esther and some of them, they have the kinsman redeemer process, and that whole process had to take place. But as that happens, without their decision, without this refusal from the brothers, she couldn't remarry. And so we don't know too much about the situation. We don't know if she just went from one guy to the next or whatever. I mean, we're probably starting with a kid that's like 12 and a half, 13, 14. It doesn't seem to make sense to marry a 13-year-old. I mean, in our culture, we have other terms for that. And so, but she's gone through five husbands, and none of those have worked out. And now she's got friends with benefits. She's living with a guy, and I suspect there's lots of reasons for that as well. But the obvious question is, when Jesus says this, I expect that there's either a really long pause before the woman speaks for one of two reasons. I suspect that she's either panicked to death that this Jesus, this person standing in front of her, all of a sudden knows more about her than you can imagine. And what is she going to do? Now, let me pause there for a moment, because I think we're kind of at a spot in this kind of journey where I do want to reaffirm some things that I think the scriptures do say. See, Jesus, of course, isn't coming from a cultural perspective. He's not going to accommodate what the culture's doing in terms of establishing what's right and wrong. He's doing it from the perspective of what does God want? What is God's character? And so we do know from situations and even from passages like Matthew 19 that we need to be reminded of God's criteria. And I say this because the obvious question is why doesn't Jesus say something to her to correct this mess that she's in? So Matthew 19, Jesus is posed with the question about, is it okay for a man to divorce a woman for any reason? Obviously has some relevance to the context what Jesus is speaking in here, although it hasn't happened yet in this sense. But obviously, how does Jesus approach this process? Well, first of all, God created humanity and made them male and female. That's what he reiterated in Matthew 19. He's quoting Genesis chapter 2. And we need to affirm that as a body of believers, that God's standard in terms of how he has created us in his image was male and female. The second element is that God creates the nature of marriage to be between one man and one female. That's what Genesis clearly establishes. It can't be more explicit, that a man shall leave his father and mother, he shall cleave to his wife, so he becomes his wife, and then the two become one flesh, which takes us to number three, God created sexual intimacy to be in the context of marriage. And this woman in John chapter 4 has literally been exploited for all kinds of things. She was married five times. We actually don't know if there was children involved, but since that was really highly prized, I suspect children are involved. And so she not only may have been divorced, but she may not be able to have access to her kids. And so when you begin to start sort of spinning the reality of her journey and trying to understand who this woman is, all of a sudden, if we're actually careful to think about it, it may stand in striking contrast to God's standard, but there's a lot of collateral damage here that I will propose to you wasn't just because she has poor character and making bad choices. And so the question becomes, how is Jesus actually going to deal with this? Because Jesus clearly is the one who's advocated God's criteria, God's standard for life and marriage. Here's a perfect opportunity from a dysfunctional human's perspective to make a really good theological point. God created marriage to be a permanent relationship till death, which Jesus says, what God has brought together, let no man separate. And then, of course, verse 9 in Matthew chapter 19, since we want to understand God's criteria, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. That's the criteria that God has set forth. I do realize there's lots of people that have discussions about the nature of what all that means, but for the sake of our discussion this morning, Jesus could come fully loaded to expose this woman to the gravity of her sin, if we wanted to put it that way. Because, hey, if we're going to get them saved, we have to make sure they know they're lost. I don't know about you, I think she knows she's in a desperate situation. And yet we, at times, are profoundly wanting to tell people that they're broken and messed up and they're sinful. And frankly, for the most part, we live in a world where people already figured that out. They've been abused, they've been exploited, they've been discriminated apart. There's no way that, in many ways, people don't understand this. Humanity has mastered the ability to not just decimate marriage, but to redefine marriage. And we're living in a culture that's doing it like a flood, which we won't take the time to deal with all that this morning. But Satan loves to exploit, which God designed to be a wonderful gift of marriage, to become an instrument of self-destructive tendencies to find security, significance, and love, and acceptance, and I believe all the wrong ways and all the wrong places. And this woman could probably attest to it. She went through 5 marriages. And if we work from the assumption that even if she was widowed from some of them, she faced the possibility of not being with her kids if she had kids, and the fact that if she was provided any lump of money, it probably won't salve the torment of her soul being exploited by 5 different people, and now maybe for the possibility of being a victim, I don't want to go back to marriage, I'll just live with somebody. So why doesn't Jesus take this opportunity to fix her morality? I mean, could you really ask for a better opportunity to clarify the error of her ways? I hope I'm sounding a little sarcastic here. And the reminder of God's criteria also not just talks about the idea of God's design, but God's deliverance. See, we have to remember that Jesus has already been talking to her about living water, the gift of God, that if she really understood who she was talking to, that he could give her something that she doesn't have and won't get from the culture and from all the experiences she's had, no matter how desperately she's seeking a sense of self-worth and value and significance as a human being, she's clearly not getting it from the culture. She's clearly not getting it from other people. She's clearly not getting it from her husbands. And in the face of all this, Jesus' first concern is redemptive. He is wanting to spiritually deliver her so that we might theorize that even being trapped in a culture that is impossible for her to free herself from, she could find living water and a sense of value even in the midst of that. But what Jesus also does is a practical deliverance. Jesus treats the woman with great respect and at the same time challenges the systemic discrimination of the culture. He's willing to step into that world and not just talk to her and go, okay, my job is done, I'm leaving, as soon as the disciples came back. He says, no, I'm willing to deal with the tough issues of what you have to face, so you go get your husband, bring him back, and then that's when the conversation will really take place. And the trouble for that we face is often we're afraid of the really tough discussions, because what the woman says and what the husband's going to come at this with might be very different attitude. But Jesus doesn't run from it. He doesn't hide from it. He doesn't be a spectator. He says, listen, you go get your husband, you bring him back, then we'll have some real down-to-earth discussions. And the respect for her confession, where she not only says, well, I have no husband, Jesus points out that he knows more than what she's telling him, but he doesn't beat her up with it. I mean, if it was us, we'd probably say, ha, I know you're lying to me. Not only do you not have a husband, but you've got friends with benefits, and you've been married 5 times, so I can't trust you at all because you're a liar. That's what we would do. Well, most of us would do. But Jesus, even knowing the truth about a reality, says, yeah, what you said is true. And he doesn't do it in a condescending way. He doesn't do it to, like, I know more about you than you realize. He apparently does it in enough of a loving and concerned and compassionate way that she doesn't run for the hills when he finishes the discussion. And regardless of how long that pause is between those two verses, which just from a human perspective, I have to feel that she sort of sat there for a minute and kind of went, And simply because of the demeanor of Jesus, she didn't see him, you know, she didn't say, are you a protester? Her conclusion in the way that Jesus talked to her is, you know, I think you're a prophet. Now, one of the problems with how Jesus deals with this is how we view her. Her life experience and or the culture has so much collateral damage when it comes to marriage and sexual immorality and rejection and exploitation that she could have said, yeah, well, whatever, this is the way life is in our culture. People are sleeping with anybody they want to. They've got friends with benefits. Marriage and divorce is rampant. So, like, yeah, this is no big deal. I'm not unique in this situation. Great, you know what about me? You must be a prophet. That's pretty good insight. And so there's a possibility that she might not panic at all because this is normal. Kind of like where our culture's going. And so as Jesus responds to her, there's something about the way he has this discussion that shows the kind of respect and compassion and love that she just doesn't bolt. And boy, is that something we have to learn. We've got to be willing to hear things that maybe we're not really comfortable hearing. We've got to learn to have discussions that maybe we don't want to acknowledge. But the respect for her reality is profound in terms of Jesus. He doesn't lose this information against her. He doesn't beat her up with it. He doesn't question her morality. And she's gone through a lot. She lives in a legalistic, oppressive, discriminatory culture where she's a victim of systemic prejudice. And it's so deeply ingrained in terms of the culture that she absolutely knows she can't do anything about it on her own. In one sense, she is a victim. Since women didn't have the power to divorce, if all these are divorces, she was vulnerable to whatever the husband decided to do. It wasn't her choice to do those things. But somebody will say, well, she probably went out without a covering on, and so she should have known better. Really? And so her personal value has probably been decimated. She's been stereotyped by the Jews, even though a Jew is talking to her, discriminated by her own culture, exploited by several men, and has nowhere to go. And she is probably the epitome of someone who's been a victim in every sense of the word. And Jesus becomes her only advocate. Jesus becomes her only advocate. What are the disciples doing? They're going and getting them food. Not wrong to go get food, they're just not in the equation right now, which is probably a good thing. And so Jesus steps into her world. He wants to know more about her life than just this legacy of collateral damage. Even to the point where he says, listen, I want to get to know more about your situation, so go get the person you're living with and bring them back and we'll have a discussion, because I suspect if he's talking to her about living water, he wants to express the same thing to him. And so Jesus, although a Jew, was an outsider to the Samaritans who stepped into her world and challenged the systematic prejudice both inside the Samaritan culture and from the Jews, by introducing his disciples ultimately, as we'll look further in the text, to care for people that they were taught were unclean and had no greater value than the Gentiles. And so Jesus was willing to do what sometimes we're not willing to do, and that is to step into someone else's world and make a difference. From our perspective, we should never step into that world unless we're taking Jesus and the gospel with us, because we'll probably do something really stupid and blow the whole thing up if we try to handle it on our own. I mean, even Jesus did that. He introduced the idea of living water and eternal life. His whole motivation was a rescue mission. And so the idea of why does Jesus not beat her up with her bad choices and all this? One of the things I want you to think about is that the Samaritan woman was religious. I mean, she was at Jacob's well. Later on in the discussion, she's going to go, are you greater than Jacob, the one who gave this to us? So she has a Jewish heritage. She has a legacy where she's been exposed to the spiritual truths of God and who he is, and she believes in God. They even built sort of a second temple in Mount Gerizim that the Jews would never recognize as being valid, but they're trying to figure out how do we, who would never be allowed over here, figure out a way that we're going to worship God, because we know they won't accept us. And there's plenty of evidence in the early documents to suggest that. They wouldn't even accept offerings from the Samaritans. And she believes in God. She has a heritage, she has religious practices, she worships God, and we're going to find out from Jesus that he's going to say, well, you worship what you don't know. And so there's a profound sense of ignorance and gap in the way that she's thinking how this needs to work. And my contention from a human perspective is I'm not sure it's all her fault. But I believe Jesus is an advocate for someone who's experiencing extreme systematic prejudice is that she needed to be rescued, not reprimanded. She needed eternal life, not to be excommunicated. She needed the Messiah, Christ, not moral correction. I mean, Jesus literally is talking to her, no matter all this religious stuff around her and her belief in God, she doesn't know the gift of God. It would be silly to impose moral standards on people who don't know the gift of God. She needed an advocate, not an attitude adjustment. She's just trying to survive. And the more time I spend thinking about this woman at the well and the cultures and the pressure, the more my heart goes out of her that she's just not a person who doesn't know how to make good choices. She's been pummeled to death and exploited and discriminated against. And I'll tell you, I got to this point in my study and I kind of went to James 4. or James 2. You know, where it says, you know, faith without works is dead. You know, you see somebody that needs clothing and you say, hey, go be blessed, may God meet your need, and you don't give them the things they need. James says, like, he doesn't use the word hypocrite, but he says, your faith is completely worthless. And what Jesus demonstrates is things that we need to learn. Is that our faith without works that's willing to advocate and move alongside people who are being crushed by discrimination and prejudice is no better than saying, hey, God, I hope God helps you. We'll pray for you, but don't ask me to get involved. I don't want to have the hard discussions. And so the principles that I think just kind of scream from the experience Jesus has is we need to be willing to learn from others that we have often ignored to learn and help deal with things like injustices and prejudice and discrimination. I've taken way too long here, but anyway, too bad. You're going to get it anyway, just because I feel it's necessary. I know of a certain public school that has a certain teacher teaching in a public school who I knew was strongly encouraged to take an accredited course for ongoing accreditation. And the tag on it was the idea of getting to understand the mindset and the value systems of Muslim boys who are black. But the course was an 8-hour course on straight Muslim religion. So I heard about this, and I called the principal. And I said, can I ask you why in a public institution that puts severe gag orders on talking about anything related to religion is now encouraging people to take a full-blown course on Islamic religion just to understand where a bunch of elementary school kids are? And I sensed that the tone of the conversation there that upticked about 6 anxiety levels was probably the same thing Jesus was having here. And sometimes all we have to do is start asking questions. We don't have to go to war with people. But some of us have never even asked the questions. It's not my business. It's not my problem. It's not my sphere of influence. But we've seen this in other venues that are on a much smaller scale. We see kids bullying other kids at school. We see social media platforms being used to vent vicious kinds of things against other people. And often we just sort of stand by as spectators and let that stuff go too, because we have a hard time with a lot of the discussions. I think we need to, like Jesus, advocate for change. Kirk Franklin is a Grammy Award-winning, actually Dove Award-winning singer and artist. And I was listening to him. Someone had sent me an interview that he had, and Tony Evans and some others had, and he said, you know, we got to stop bashing one another and labeling one another. If we keep blaming each other, we're never going to get anywhere. But his appeal was this: the black and brown communities of our culture need the help of white churches to advocate and move alongside them to help deal with the discrimination and injustices in our culture as a piece of the process. His example was this: if there's a fire in a neighborhood, they send a fire truck into the neighborhood because a house is on fire. It doesn't mean all the other houses and families around in the neighborhood don't mean anything, but if there's a house on fire, they're the ones that need the water right now. He was talking about the idea of Black Lives Matter, not whether we was talking about the organization, but his statement, Kirk Franklin's statement, he says, we know all lives matter, but if the house is on fire, it would be helpful if people gave some attention to that particular house so we can put out the fire, and then we can move on to the other things. But one of the concern, and I read it at the beginning where Ed Lutzer quoted some people and even Barack Obama about the moral relativism in our culture, is that one of the things we also have to be concerned about is our own hypocrisy. And that stems from the idea is that we claim to be Christians and want to do the right thing. I don't know anyone that doesn't want to do the right thing. But sometimes in our own environment, we can be very much like the woman at the well. You know, she claimed to believe in God. They had a place where she worshiped. She was engaged in religious activities. But she didn't even recognize the Savior who was standing right in front of him. And one of the concerns that we have to be careful about is that it's easy to judge other people for stuff, but moral relativism is now sort of treating things like divorce and remarriage as, if you're not happy, just dump it. Not that we should ever advocate that people should stick together regardless of how abusive or discriminatory it is to say, well, just for the sake of saying we're keeping it together, this ought to be here. But there's things like sexual immorality that's becoming pervasive even in our Christian communities. I don't believe in marriage anymore. We'll just do our own thing. And we've got to be careful that we don't buy into the same cultural pressure that we think we ought to be fighting in terms of systemic prejudice by engaging in it ourselves. What did Romans 2? I know you've missed Romans, so we'll go back there. He challenges them. He says, you who judge other people, you end up doing the very same thing. And we've got segments of our culture that have that need living water to quench the desperate and torment of their soul and their spirit. They don't need a theological lecture. They don't need us to point out how messed up their life is. They don't need us to talk about all the collateral damage they've caused. Because half the time, if we get under the surface and start seeing these are real people in real journeys who've been exploited by other real, broken, messed up, sinful people, that we'd see ourselves on a rescue mission rather than a reprimand. Where do you start? Well, I started by phoning a school district and asking questions. I started a week ago by calling an inner city black African-American pastor who I talked for an hour and a half with about what does all this mean. Help me learn where you're coming from. It's learning from podcasts to listen to the other side so that I can learn that every single culture has systemic problems with it. And we have to start stepping into it and having the hard conversations. And I guess the courage of our faith, and we'll see this as we move through John chapter 4, is Jesus was willing to go where no one usually wants to go. In this day and age, the courage isn't coming to church. The courage is to stepping alongside others and being an advocate to help them deal with the oppression and the prejudice. But we have to do it through the lens of the gospel, because in the flip side that you can gain the world and forfeit yourself, you can fix the problem and still lose a person's soul because we're not offering that which really satisfies the thirst of tormented souls of men and women. Got a long way to go. We can't fix it in a week. But maybe it starts with one single conversation at a time. And willing to have the difficult conversations. Willing to go there? It's tough. It means sacrifice and change. Stepping into other people's world. But I think this is what God has called us to do. As we proclaim the gospel of Jesus to a broken humanity. Father, we're in somewhat uncharted waters, and yet we've been swimming in them for a long time. We can't go back and fix our history. We need to acknowledge it. At times we need to confess our sin of being absent, of being indifferent. Father, I think those of us who understand Jesus' example means it just starts with today. And taking steps of faith into other people's world and learning that you care about everyone. Sometimes we're profoundly fearful. We not only don't know what to do, but we allow that fear to keep us from doing anything. I understand at times it feels like a trap game. No matter whether you do anything or not, it's going to be the wrong thing, and what good is that going to do? But that's where we need others from different ethnic groups to help us along, to take us by the hand, help us to understand their world, and learn how to be an advocate of Christ in the midst of broken humanity. So we ask for your wisdom, for your grace, for the power of Christ to work in us, not simply to make our lives comfortable, but to make us what could be the most powerful force in our world in changing it for the sake of your kingdom. And for this we pray in Christ's name, amen.